Welcome to Real Talk, real estate discussions with Andrew Kirsch. In each episode, Andrew interviews industry leaders. We'll hear their real-time opinions on today's market, their background and unique career highlights, and guidance for newcomers to the industry. You can find this show at www.sklarkirsch.com and on YouTube, LinkedIn, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts and more. Now here's the host of Real Talk, Andrew Kirsch.
Episode 14 of Real Talk. This week, I sit down with my former Latham & Watkins colleague, Jim Dillaloo. Jim is one of the co-founders and principals of Paragon Commercial Group. Jim made the switch from being a practicing lawyer to full-time business person in the real estate industry. Paragon is one of the best in class retail owner operators, mostly in California, but specifically grocery anchored centers. We get into a really deep dive discussion on retail, the different types of sub asset classes within retail, the capital that is flowing into retail, the secret sauce as to what makes a retail center work, the secret sauce as to what makes a new company work. And it's really a free-flowing discussion on the asset class that has had a lot of that headwinds over the last 10, 15 years. And we both agree that over the last 6 to 12 months, there's been more interest in grocery anchored centers from the capital world than I've seen in my career. It's an interesting discussion and one that I think you'll find interesting as well.
Hello, welcome to another episode of Real Talk. It is my pleasure to have my old Latham & Watkins colleague, Jim Dillaloo, co-founder of Paragon Commercial Group. Jim, how you doing, man?
Andrew, I'm great. How are you? I heard you were at NMHC in Vegas yesterday.
Yeah, you know, nothing like 3,000 guys in blue blazers dancing at Marquee at the Cosmo. That is my definition of a good time.
Welcome back to reality. Now you've got to work.
Yeah, this is work, right? You know, it's slow when lawyers are spending more time doing podcasts than closing deals. But first and foremost, where does this podcast find you?
I'm sitting in my office in El Segundo, California, and I apologize if I sound a little bit like Kermit the Frog. I'm at the end of what people in red states refer to as the common cold. But I'll do my best here.
So not COVID, but a common cold, or it is COVID, but you're just calling it a common cold.
No, there is no common cold in blue states. So my doctor told me that in red states, it's called the common cold. But if I went to a blue state, they would call it something else.
Fair enough. All right. Well, you look like you're in a pretty cool office, brick walls. So this is where you guys reside for Paragon?
Yeah, we bought an old 1950s warehouse in El Segundo, in the old industrial district of El Segundo called Smoky Hollow, and we renovated and turned it into our office.
Oh, that's awesome. Any other tenants, or you're the only tenant in the building?
We're the only tenant. We bought a couple other buildings. We're actually one block away from one of your last guests, Steve Ludwig at Coastline Capital. He's one block over from us.
Yeah. I know exactly them where you are. I've been to their offices, but you know, Ludwig you likes to just hang out in the 619 area code and sometimes graces us with his appearance in LA County.
That's true.
So let's get right into it. Tell our audience, what is Paragon Commercial Group?
All right, before I get into Paragon, I want to hijack your show for a second because none of your guests ever ask you questions or tell the history of Andrew Kirsch.
I can't wait for this.
I'm going to take it upon myself to do that right now. and reminisce a little bit about when we were junior associates at Latham & Watkins, and we had just started, I guess, first year, second year, third year, wandering the halls of the 40th to 45th floors of the library tower in downtown LA until 1, 2, and 3 in the morning on a regular basis, closing deals for Credit Suisse and Deutsche Bank and whoever else was closing deals before the GFC. And so that's how Andrew and I got to know each other. And you get to know someone really well when you work with them till those hours of the morning. And so I look back on those times very fondly, Andrew. And it was you know, fun working with you and getting to know you during the time. And it's been really cool to see what you've done with your firm over the last few years. And so, you know, I kind of want to hijack the show here and just congratulate you a little bit for what you've done.
Wow. Well, I appreciate it because I was going to talk about our Latham days, but it was going to be a lot less complimentary. And so now I feel bad. I'm going to have to change my entire script of our Latham days. But, you know, let's start during those Latham days. You know, it's sort of like when you see the tree of real estate professionals that came out of McGuire, right? From Philip Orozco, yeah. And, you know, Josh Roble on the brokerage side and so many others. And we did a lot of work for McGuire when we were at Latham. And we can say the same thing about the Latham tree and from Paul Furman to you. And yeah, I got my little law firm and a podcast, but that's all I got going on. But it really is, and I mean it, you know, truly exciting just to see the success of our former colleagues, former peers, and I've tracked your career and how successful Paragon has been. And I'd like to think that, you know, our days roaming the halls and nights roaming the halls at Latham had something to do with it. Maybe, you know, they did teach us a thing or two there.
Yeah, I was speaking to a company last week in Orange County and about kind of building companies, and they said, the question was, well, would you ever go back and be a lawyer again? And I said, absolutely 100% I would do it. And they were all kind of surprised. And they said, well, why? What did it teach you that allowed you to then go build a company? And I said, that's easy. It's just grit. You learn good old grit. You know, when there's a line at the Starbucks in your building at 5 p.m. because you know, everyone wants their big coffee for the night, you learn how to kind of dig in. And you and I both worked with a guy named Paul Furman who had an insatiable work ethic. And everyone in that the real estate group at Latham did. But that's what it taught us, you, me, and everybody else that's kind of done big firm law. So whether or not we enjoyed the law part of it, we absolutely learned the grit that's needed. And I think that's what translates. And that's why you see people go out and are able to start companies, start law firms, and build careers, because you learn that skill set. Whether you're there for 1 year or 5 years, it probably doesn't matter much, but you learn what true work ethic is. And that's what's treated me well. I mean, I've never ever been the smartest guy in the room, but I've always been able to outwork anyone in the room. And that I attribute that to my days at Latham.
When we were interviewing you for at Latham, you did say you were the smartest guy in the room. So you lied to us.
I thought I hired you. Did you hire me?
I think neither, because I, from law school, I'm class of 2000. Are you 01 or 02?
02.
So, okay. So I may have helped with your summer associate hiring.
there you go.
Taking you to Matsuhisa or Koi or Katana or whatever the end restaurant.
This was the pre-GFC days where everyone was fat and happy and no one could do wrong. And so there was some free flowing expenditures for summer associate classes, to be sure. Different days now, Andrew. It's different days.
Totally different days. I mean, I tell my associates now, and we're gonna cut to real estate real soon here because I'm gonna lose my audience. But I feel badly because the associates that are at our firm will never realize and never experience what a true summer associate program was like. And during those years between 2000 and 2006, I mean, we literally got a blank check just to entertain. And it was, those are some fun days and fun evenings.
All right, so now let's talk about real estate.
There we go. Paragon.
Okay. So Paragon is a product of a couple of things, and I'll tie it quickly to Latham. It's a product of, I recall very vividly, sitting in my office on the 44th floor at 2 o'clock in the morning, sending out wires for a closing the following morning, and realizing that while I was the guy who worked 80 hours the week before leading up to the closing, my clients were the people making the money. And I was the only guy sitting in an office at 2 o'clock in the morning sending wires for a closing. So I decided, okay, I got to figure out a way to get on the business side of things and take my, you know, what I'd learned on the legal side of things and transition it to the business side. So that was kind of the impetus for learning the business. Now, the one thing you don't learn as a lawyer is any of the business side. You learn the legal side, you don't learn the business side. So I needed a bridge to learn underwriting, to learn Excel, things you just don't learn as a lawyer. And so I left Latham to go to a public REIT called Regency Centers, which and we ran the West Coast. Our office in LA ran the West Coast of Regency Centers. And we had a huge portfolio of shopping centers, Denver West. I want to say it was, you know, 250, 300 shopping centers. And that's where I learned the business side of the business before I started.
But Jim, did you go in as an in-house counsel or did you go in as a business person?
Yeah, 100% as a business person.
How did you get that job?
I got that job because I used to go to the gym every morning downtown at 5 a.m. And there was a bunch of people who work downtown who obviously be at the gym. And one night I pulled an all-nighter at Latham. I was there till about 4:30 in the morning. And I decided that instead of driving home, I was just going to go to the gym, jump on the treadmill, and just get it started again for the next day. So I walked in and I ran into a guy who said, "Man, Jim, you look tired." I say, "I just pulled an all-nighter, but I'm going to jump on the treadmill here because I got to get back to work." And the guy happened to be the managing director of Regency on the West Coast. And he said, "You and I need to talk because I need a guy like you." So that's how I ended up getting that job on the business side.
Wow. That is not an easy task to be able to pivot from law to business in just a one job, you know, switch. Usually it's like in-house counsel and then you sort of morph into a business related job, or you just go cold turkey and start your own company. So what?
Yeah, I knew nothing. I knew nothing.
And so talk about those first several months, first year. What was it like?
It was a huge learning curve. I went in. Well, first of all, I took a 75% pay cut to do it. So it's not all glamorous. But I know I needed that skill set and that was missing in my repertoire. So I knew I needed to do that for a year or two.
Were you married?
Yes. And my next question was, you know, was my wife happy? And the answer was no. Actually, yeah. Not only was I married, we were under construction on a house. We had one baby at home and my wife was pregnant with the second.
Wow.
But I always tell people, anyone who's asked me about starting a company, I always tell them the single most important thing is a supportive spouse, because there is zero chance I would have done this if I got any friction at home for doing it. And she basically said, "Absolutely, go do it. If you think it's the right thing, I trust you." And that gave me the kind of confidence to go do it. So that's, you know, I knew it was a 2-year learning period and I was taking a few steps back, but I absolutely needed that skill set in order to then get on the business side myself.
So during, all right, so you, how long were you at Regency?
So I was there for 2 years and then the GFC hit, which was actually perfect timing because all of the REITs at the time, I was on the development side of the business. So we were, you know, buying land, entitling land, signing leases, and developing shopping centers. And the GFC hit. Well, all of the REITs just focused on asset management at that point. They didn't want any FFO on the balance sheet coming from development deals. And so it was perfect because I knew enough about the legal side and the business side to then go out in the GFC, where nobody on the planet wanted to talk about buying or building retail in 2008, 2009. It was an absolute bad word. All of real estate was, but retail even more so. So it was kind of the perfect moment, if you believe in contrarian investment philosophies. It was the perfect moment to go out into the world, you know, plant a flag, raise your hand and say, "Hey, I'm going to go start buying and building retail." everyone on the planet thought I was nuts. But that's a good sign to me, because all it takes is one. And we started, you know, we founded the company in 2009 at the bottom of the GFC. We thought we were going to be buying distressed CMBS loans, but, you know, ended up just kind of getting directly into development.
How did you meet your co-founders?
I met them at Regency, and the secret sauce here was simply that because I'd come out of Latham, and you know this, you know, we did a lot of debt and equity work. And so I really understood capital structuring on the debt and equity side, and that was my forte. I was very weak on the tenant relationship side. And the secret sauce to all of retail is tenant relationships. That's why it's so hard for private equity to penetrate the business, because at the end of the day, you have to be a sponsor to actually do this well. And so I knew that I couldn't do it myself because I didn't have 10 or 20 years of tenant relationships. So I partnered with guys from Regency who've been doing this for 20 plus years who had those relationships, which are, you know, with the anchor tenants, which are critical as a catalyst to any development deal.
And so one last question on Regency before we go to Paragon. When you went to Regency and you had that, you know, fortuitous meeting at 4 or 5 in the morning on the treadmill, did you know that you wanted to go into retail, or it was just you knew you wanted to go into the business world within real estate, and it just so happened that your opportunity was in retail?
Yeah, it's a good question. I actually did not know anything about retail. In fact, if you would have asked me, I would have told you I would have probably gone into multifamily, because I had been buying, you know, again at, you know, 1, 2, 3 o'clock in the morning when you're sitting at your desk, I've been investing in multifamily projects in Hollywood and Koreatown. And so I probably would have gone into multifamily. I knew nothing about retail. What I learned about retail was that the barriers to entry in the asset class are higher than any other asset class, in my opinion, because it's just so complicated, such a complicated mousetrap. And so I thought the moat around retail was deep and wide. And so that's kind of where I like to play. The barriers to entry were high, and I felt like I had a skill set. And when I, you know, with my partners that where we could excel and set ourselves apart very quickly on the West Coast, just because we had a good track record coming out of Regency.
So sitting in 2009, which is completely different from, I know things aren't great now. Although I do want to talk about today's market. Although there's a lack of transactions, there's a ton of optimism. There's a ton of capital just sitting on the sidelines. And you know, you did mention that I just got back from NMHC, which is a multifamily conference, but I have never seen more people more optimistic about the next 12, 24, 36 months, but yet they're not doing anything. Contrast that with 2008, 2009, it was not optimistic. There were no transactions. People were just figuring out which way was up, workouts, giving back properties. It was not a good time, and there wasn't a lot of capital. So starting a company at that time period, how did you get capital to do your first few deals?
Yeah, I guess two comments on that. I'll answer your question. But my first comment is the nature of the real estate business is optimistic. So every single person in real estate is optimistic right up until they're out of real estate or unemployed. That's just the nature of everyone in our business.
But you're saying they're delusional.
That you have to be delusional to be in our business, because that's just how it is. Very few people are realistic in our business. And they get realistic in a hurry when, like, the bank takes your property back or they can't afford the debt service. But for the most part, you're always going to hear developers and investors be optimistic, because real estate is an investment business. It's a long-term investment business. And so you can always change the time horizon on your investment to make it a good investment, right? If 1 or 2 years didn't work out, now it's a 10-year investment. So there's always that element of optimism, and that's what keeps people coming back to the business. But we saw in 08, 09, people were optimistic. Everyone was talking about, you know, how they're going to start buying CMBS and distressed deals. And everyone's always looking to be optimistic. That's just human nature. I don't fault anyone for that. But I do agree with you that there's more capital on the sidelines. I think nothing's going to happen with that capital right now. It's definitely on the sidelines. It will get invested. I do agree with you that this is nothing like 08, 09. But as we all know, private equity moves our business, and private equity tends to follow private equity. No one wants to be the first mover in private equity, unfortunately, which is why we prefer to invest with high net worth individuals who have longer investment horizons and can get in earlier. Private equity also typically misses the market almost always. They're always late to get in and, you know, earlier late to get out. And it's just because it's so, there's so much of it and there's very few, and the incentive structure in the private equity world is built so that people, that nobody who is on an invest, that's not true. Nobody who's on a director of acquisitions who allocates capital gets paid for taking outsized risk. They get paid for taking market risk. That means they want to do what the market does, and that's how they get paid. So there's very few private equity shops out there. There are a couple. I guess if they're, a lot of them are called hedge funds, but there are private equity shops that will take that risk, that'll begin to jump in before everyone else because they see that they can make incremental value vis-a-vis the risk profile. But for the most part, they're all going to sit around. Debt's going to stabilize. They'll all tiptoe back into the market. But I agree with you. It's not going to be catastrophic. In the meantime, if you can, you know, what's the Sam Zell quote? Stay alive till 25. If you can kind of withstand 23 and into 24, I think you'll be fine. But in the meantime, your debt service is going to go up, and it's going to be hard to get deals closed.
Yeah, no, agreed. And that's what everyone's talking about is waiting for there to be stability in the debt markets, and maybe with the Fed tapering off the increase quarter basis point yesterday, narratives indicating that they are likely at the end, or, you know, maybe one more increase in the next time they meet. But let's talk about Paragon in 09. Talk about the first couple of deals you did, how you capitalized them, and just those early days.
Yeah, so the early days are scrappy days, just like your early days or anybody else's early days, which we did a couple of small deals. Our first shopping center we bought, I believe, was in the city of Carson. I met the equity through my ULI counsel, and that was as a high net worth family office out of Texas. And that was our first deal. And so we decided early on institutional, just because of what I'd experienced working for private equity shops at Latham, that we did not want private equity investors. We were going to go all high net worth, because our fundamental belief is that real estate, especially retail and grocery anchored real estate, is a long-term investment. We are investors, not traders. So we do not get in and out of deals quickly. We buy and hold, and our goal is to buy and hold long-term. And so in order to match capital horizon or duration with that investment philosophy, we had to go to high net worth. So the goal was to have two or three or four high net worth and or family offices. We don't syndicate any deals. We have one investor in every deal. And just to go build a long-term portfolio in urban infill areas of grocery anchored shopping centers, which we A, had the relationship with, and B, thought were an underappreciated asset class. And this was the pitch we were trying to give in 09. It was a harder pitch to give then than it is now, but it's, the last 13 years have told it, you know, tested the, I call it battle tested retail and battle tested grocery. And I think we've emerged in a really good spot today. So I think the philosophy is finally coming true.
Yeah. And I definitely want to talk about today's market, because we're doing more grocery anchored centers now. And there's more interest in grocery anchored centers now than I think there's ever been. I think for a couple of reasons, and I'd love to get your opinion. In COVID, people wanted to go back to the outdoor power center, retail center. They wanted to breathe fresh air. They wanted to experience service-oriented retail. And with the decline in office, significant decline in office, a lot of capital has allocated their real estate dollars towards retail, and they've gone away from office. Has it been easier to capitalize deals in the last, say, 12 to 24 months because of that shift?
Yeah, there is no doubt that there's more focused on grocery anchored right now. And there's two main reasons for that. One is we've had this retail apocalypse narrative for the last however many years, seven years. Yeah. And the reality is that, you know, from the GFC to COVID to e-commerce narrative to the retail apocalypse narrative, grocery anchored shopping centers have absolutely been battle tested. I mean, they've had everything thrown at them. And let me back up for one second. It's really important. We do a terrible job of this in our business, in the retail business, to differentiate all of these sub asset classes within retail. So when someone says retail, everyone kind of thinks malls, right? There's malls, there's lifestyle centers, power centers, community centers, neighborhood centers, there's triple net, there's strip, there's high street, there's 10 different types of retail. So, and all of those behave totally differently. They, over the last decade, last two decades, it's almost as though they're totally separate asset classes. So what we do is grocery anchored. That, if you understand that fact right there, you understand more than probably 90% of the private equity guys in the world. Once you do get that, and then you just focus in on grocery anchored shopping centers, you realize that, holy smoke, these things have been really, really bulletproof over the last multiple cycles, and they've been tested multiple times. So what's happening right now, you're exactly right. Office is not a favorite asset class. No one's done retail for the last 10 years for the most part, because there hasn't been really a niche to do it. And so everyone's looking at their private equity pie chart, trying to figure out how they get exposure to retail. And really the only place they want exposure to retail is grocery. Now, grocery is very difficult because the deal sizes are small. Our deal sizes are 20 to 40 million bucks typically. It's very hard to scale the business. And so it's not as easy as investing in a $300 million office building and say, hey, I just put the $300 million to work. You need to buy like six grocery anchor shopping centers. That's not easy to do. So I think you're exactly right. There's this awareness that A, nobody has enough retail from a diversification standpoint, just because of the last 10 years. B, office is not favored right now, so they have a lot of capital on hand that needs to be deployed in real estate. And C, people are looking around going, wow, grocery actually did well. So I think those three things are all converging, and everyone's looking at 2023 thinking, and we're risk off right now. We're in a total risk off environment. And so everyone wants just a healthy market return without taking outsized risk. And that's what grocery does. It's kind of boring. I mean, it's real boring. It just produces like a nice, durable, long-term return. And it doesn't have the sexy, you know, mark-to-market nightly rates that hot hotel does. And it doesn't have the annual mark-to-markets that some multifamily does. But it's got rent bumps built in. And the downside risk is minimal. And we've got 13 years of data to show that. We at Paragon have 13 years of data to show that. So I think the private equity is taking notice of that, and as are high net worth individuals, and they're focused on that asset class going forward, which is for the first time in 13 years.
Well, let me test the downside for a second, because some clients of mine, some investor clients of mine would be concerned with respect to retail of just the number of bankruptcies that that we've seen in the retail market. So how do you protect your downside, knowing that there are a lot of retailers who still, you know, they are suffering from an e-commerce world?
Yeah, so the good news is that has all fleshed itself out. So two comments. One is all of those weak balance sheet retailers, by and large, are now gone because they couldn't survive COVID when they had the mandatory shutdowns. And then the second comment is any retailers that did survive, let's say Party City and Bed Bath & Beyond, the two most recent bankruptcies. If you own a center with those tenants in them and you didn't know they were filing bankruptcy, you should not be in retail. Those tenants have been on bankruptcy. It's not even being tongue in cheek. Those tenants have been on bankruptcy watch lists for years and years and years. Yeah. So if you are caught off guard by one of them filing, and we can go through who is likely and not likely to file bankruptcy. So in our centers, and by the way, those are more, there are some Party Cities in grocery anchor shopping centers, but Bed Bath & Beyond is typically more of a power center tenant.
Sure.
So I mean, it's just, you got to get into the nuance of this stuff. Our centers don't have bankruptcies. I mean, we have grocery store, drug store. We have, you know, some banks, mom and pop tenants who are typically there 10 to 20 years, you know, have a long operating history, you know, support their family based on that location. So we're not in the business of taking risk. We're co-investing in all these deals ourselves. We're very, two of the three of us who are founders of the company are lawyers. We're not risky people. We're not traditional developers. We're trying to buy and invest in good, durable income streams and then create value during our hold period. So we're not cowboys. Which probably makes us not that boring, but makes us nice and safe, which for the first time in 13 years is people have decided they want to look at those types of investments.
In a type of a tenant like a bank that you mentioned, are you concerned that banks will be far less users of real estate in the future?
100%. There's no doubt about it. All of the bank prototypes, it's a good observation by you, by the way. All the banks are absolutely changing their prototypes. They're shrinking their prototypes. They're trying to figure out you know, how they maintain a bricks and mortar presence, which they do need for their consumers, but minimizing their footprint. So they're absolutely shrinking. I mean, obviously banking, I don't remember the last time I've gone to a bank. And I don't think most people do, but every once in a while, you know, you need to go to a bank. So the banking world is working on that right now. All of the major banks have prototypes and that they're working on that I've seen that are super interesting in terms of what the future of banking is going to look like. You need, for example, a larger footprint with more ATMs in some of the infill urban neighborhoods. And then when you get to affluent neighborhood banks, don't need as much footprint. They don't need as many ATMs. They're not used as much. So it does depend demographically a little bit. But yes, that is a category that 10 years ago, the banks would trade in the triple debt market, you know, five in California, 4 to 5 caps. There's pressure on that cap right now because there's questions around the durability of that income stream. Even if these banks are signing 20-year leases, you know, there's questions about whether they need to be in 5,000 feet or they can do the same thing out of 2,000 feet.
Yeah. I mean, look, it's no different whether it's retail or office. It's everyone is talking about how to more efficiently use their real estate. You know, one last thought on the fact that there's more capital coming into retail than ever before. Does it make it more challenging today to find deals, given that there's more of a demand for retail and your type of retail, grocery anchored center retail, than in the last 13 years?
Yeah, it does. People are realizing that they don't want to let go of them. Part of what we were able to feed on over the last 13 years was the fear around retail and the fear around retail and just the future. And so, yes, you did have a lot of, especially families who were disposing of what was once a grocery anchored shopping center was once viewed as a triple net investment by and large by families. And they could live off of that income for generations. Once retail prototypes started changing, shrinking, all of a sudden that asset needed capital, it needed architects, it needed contractors, it needed leasing. It ceased to be a triple net asset or a stable asset at least, and it became much more of a transitional asset. That's when that on top of the retail apocalypse narrative, people started getting rid of them. They were really scared of the future of retail. I think that is reversing itself right now. And so yes, people are trying to figure out how to hold on to these assets. Now, fundamentally, it's actually quite difficult to reposition a grocery anchor shopping center for a bunch of different reasons. We can talk about prohibited uses, exclusives, CAMs, protected areas, all that fun stuff. It's actually not easy to do. And so it does take a sharpshooter to do it. So those kind of same passive families are will dispose of the assets as prototypes change and retailers change and relationships change. But yes, I think people are trying to figure out how to hold on, especially if they have a grocery store. They're trying to figure out how to hold on to those assets. And banks are giving them good debt, you know, for the first time too. Banks are like, hey, we want to lend on grocery anchored shopping centers. So they're getting better debt terms, which allows them to be held longer by the owners. So yeah, you're exactly right.
Yeah. And are you doing, and you may have mentioned this before, are you buying ground up? Are you developing ground up as well as buying a value add center?
Yeah. So our pedigree is ground up. We've built probably 13 million square feet on the West Coast ground up. The ground up development world in retail, obviously for the last cycle, whatever that may be, was less robust because the West and the US in general is highly over retailed. And so the game became much more of a repositioning game than a ground up development. We didn't need net new square footage of retail. We needed broken centers fixed.
Yeah.
And whether that means re-entitled and converted to multifamily, whether that means, you know, 55,000 square foot boxes, grocery stores, you know, demise to 35,000 foot grocery stores, and then the other piece of it released. So we've done a lot of repositioning over the last 10 years. We have built ground up. We are building ground up right now in Studio City. We finished a ground up center in Manhattan Beach. So we will do ground up but I guess we need to clarify, it's all pre-leased. So I don't know if that's true. We're not doing anything spec. We won't even build a shop building spec. It's going to be 100% pre-leased. We like both. We know both. But the world we've lived in for the last decade has been really more of a repositioning world than a net new ground up entitlement kind of greenfield world.
So walk us through when you say pre-leased. I mean, obviously you have your grocery center, who grocery anchor who's taking 35,000 feet, your drugstore who's taking, I don't know what, 10, 15, 20,000 feet. Even the inline stores, they're all pre-leased before you're
starting. I mean, that's the goal. That's the goal. We don't need those necessarily pre-leased. And oftentimes those guys don't even show up to the table until a little bit later in the game, because they want to see the center built before they want to sign a lease. So they don't have as much of a risk tolerance as some of the anchor tenants that are more familiar with how the game works. But I'll take, for example, a center we just finished out in Riverside. We built a ground up Stater Brothers anchored center that has an AutoZone and a Ross in it. So in that center, well, we have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 pads. In that center, we had all the anchors, which are AutoZone, Ross, and Stater Brothers, fully executed by the time we closed on the loan and started construction. And then we had, I believe, 2 of the pads leased, but we had one pad that we knew would lease, but so we didn't want to do it too early. And then we had a few vacant shop suites where we were comfortable not having pre-leased. And so it's a balance too between what we want to do, which is take as much risk off the table, and what a bank wants us to do, which is take all the risk off the table, right? So you're right. We will try to lease it 100%, but if we're 80 to 90% and we're very confident in the remaining 10 or 20, we'll do that.
Yeah. Now, in terms of, I've seen some unbelievable technology with respect to retail real estate. And I know retail is, like you said, could encompass 10 different sub asset classes. And yeah, I'm sure you know Sandy Siegel of Newmark Merrill, and he is very into technology, and he's shown me the technology of where he can spot like the clusters of people within his centers and what works and what doesn't, and sort of reposition the programming within a center all the way to a company that I have invested in. I know Sandy's invested in called Placer to look at, you know, demographics and density and other things. So how much is technology played a part in your decisions to go into a particular location?
Yeah, I think it's so there's technology plays a role. I don't know that it plays the dominant role. I think at the end of the day, it's very much of a understanding of the consumer. And some of that is just sitting and reflecting on how people shop. This is not brain surgery. This is understanding people's shopping patterns, their habits, cross shopping, sitting at shopping centers, which, you know, I talked to Jeff Kreshek at Federal about this. It's funny. He and I are both geeks, and that we'll go sit at shopping centers and watch behavior of people and watch now. So that's interesting, but where the Placer element comes in, and obviously for those who listen to this, who don't know what that is, it's basically a technology that tracks cell phones and where they're located, for how long they're located. So you can see individuals, where they go, where they came from, where they went after the shopping center, how long they stayed at the center. That's all very valuable to know. What that doesn't translate to, though, is actual sales volumes, which at the end of the day is what matters. And so I think it's a helpful tool, but it's not outcome determinative in the decisions we make. We do look at it. And I think it's super interesting more than anything else. And I know Sandy's kind of at the forefront in terms of data analysis on his portfolio and sure, understanding the consumer. But it's a tool. It's a tool. I think kind of gut instinct is even more important, and just understanding how people shop. And by the way, people shop differently in the South Bay than they do in Hollywood, than they do in Riverside, than they do in San Diego. And so it's actually extremely granular and localized, which is why I continue to like the space, meaning that capital can't get into our world without sharpshooters on the ground. I'm always entertained by private equity shops who invest in asset classes, and they invest in everything across the board, across the United States. And so I sit there and I think, how is it possible that you're an expert in every asset class in every market across the United States? We largely are just West Coast and predominantly California. And I still, is the fifth largest economy in the world, I still don't know every corner in California. So,
yeah. Or even in LA County. I mean, it's, yeah.
So yeah, I mean, it's a very localized business, especially now when consumer behaviors change so rapidly, understanding how people shop, why they shop, what the motivations are, how long they stay, how long they stay in a store, what the basket size is, what the, you know, we look at all of these metrics when determining what the right anchor tenant is and what the right tenant mix is for any center.
Well, I mean, you're almost like a producer of a movie in that you want the right, you know, actor, actress, director, writer, and supporting actors in a retail center to make sure that they all complement each other and create the most revenue for all of your tenants. And I mean, that's got to be, like you said, a very challenging task given each individual location, demographics, culture. And so how do you learn about the different behavior patterns of a South Bay resident versus a Studio City resident versus a Riverside resident?
You have to be a geek. I mean, you just have to, you know, when you're out on the weekends, nights, mornings, wherever you go, instead of going to your coffee shop to get a cup of coffee, you're actually going to your coffee shop to get a cup of coffee, but also to observe who's there, where they come from, where are they parking, where are they not parking, how easy was it to park, right? That my mind is constantly going to all of those questions when I go to a restaurant for lunch, when I go out for dinner, how was the service, what's on the menu, how far away, you know, all of these things factor in. So my mind is constantly analyzing all of that. And it quickly, when you do that, it quickly becomes apparent who a good operator is, who chooses real estate wisely, who chooses real estate poorly, who knows how to build out a restaurant, who doesn't know how to build out a restaurant. So, and all of those factors go into the types of tenants that we think are the most durable. So keep in mind, we're signing minimum 10-year leases if you're talking about shop tenants. And then if you're talking about anchor, you know, tenants, 15 to 20 year leases. And these have like 6-5 year options on them, right? So this is, you're getting married for anywhere between 20 to 60 years. So you need to diligence these tenants all the way down to, you know, everything about them, their P&Ls, their balance sheet, their operations. We'll have calls with the CFO. We'll look at the financials. We need to diligence everything we can diligence to get comfortable that they're going to be viable long-term, because consumer behaviors change constantly.
Yeah. Jim, you ready for a lightning round set of questions to end Real Talk?
Do it.
Let's go. The first question may be controversial, and if you want to punt on it, I will allow you. Are you ready? Because you did offer it up. Tell me one or two tenants that you think will not be around by the end of this year.
I'm always by the end of this year. Oh, that's a tough crystal ball.
Do you want me to lengthen it out to the end of 24?
So look at I always look at categories where there's too many tenants. So for example, a few years ago, I look at like the burger category. Everybody was getting into fast casual burgers. They can't all survive. There's not enough market share for them. So coffee has been extremely saturated. And the rents that they're paying are high. So look for some of the smaller coffee operators not to make it, especially when they don't have good technology like and can't compete with Starbucks. Large restaurant operators are a huge struggle because of labor costs, especially in California. So anything that's above, you know, 3,500 square feet, you know, 5,000 square feet, anything larger than that is going to be very, very difficult to maintain because taxes are going up, fees are going up, labor is going up, and just the P&L doesn't work anymore. So those categories you got to be careful of.
Any categories of retailers that you're underexposed that you want more of in your centers?
Yeah, we've done a lot of business with Target, and they're just an outstanding, thoughtful retailer in terms of merchandising their stores, local merchandising, changing merchandise between stores. I mean, they got different stuff in Hollywood than they have in USC Village, than they have in the South Bay. I mean, they're really, really granular and thoughtful in terms of their merchandising. So we continue to love to work with them. They have a great management team. So from an anchor standpoint, they're excellent. All the grocers, we've done a number of deals with Sprouts, Stater Brothers, Trader Joe's, all the grocers really are where our focus is right now. And the ones that are surviving and expanding are the ones that have figured out how to be profitable. And the grocery business is a very difficult business. And so, you know, we've done some deals with Aldi. They're all really, really good. So we really like to hitch our wagon to those quality tenants that we are going to believe are going to be around for a long time that drive a lot of foot traffic to the center, and then we can merchandise off that.
I know you're Western United States, mostly California. Is there a market you haven't yet transacted in that you would like to transact in?
We've been kicking around Dallas here for a while. The working investment thesis there is that Dallas has been growing horizontally and now has started to, with the influx of, frankly, people, will start over the next 10 years to grow vertically. And it will mirror what LA did, call it 15 years ago, when retailers started to get comfortable going in vertical mixed use development. So you remember like the first Ralphs in downtown, whatever, however many years ago, 15, 20 years ago, it was the front page of every, just because it went in a mixed use project. When we put Whole Foods in Playa Vista, on a podium, it was a head scratcher. People were trying to, what? It's not a ground floor. There's not accurate parking. Got to park in a parking structure. Well, LA is really adapted to that now. And so retailers and consumers are becoming accustomed to that. That's going to happen in Dallas here in the next cycle, or in different parts of Texas. That's just one market. So the short answer to your question is Texas, Dallas.
Yeah. Well, that's because all of everyone from Los Angeles has moved to Dallas.
That is correct. Yes.
all right. Last question. Best advice someone has given you?
Best advice someone has given me is just put your head down. And I, you know what, I'll tell you who gave me the advice. It was Paul Furman. When I was a junior associate and he was the chair of the real estate department at Latham. And he just said, Jim, it's a marathon, not a sprint. He said, just put your head down, work hard. And I promise you it will work out. And so whenever I get into situations where I'm either concerned about the market or concerned about deal flow or concerned about anything else, just put your head down, put in the extra hours, work hard, and it will turn out well. And that's treated me well.
This is when I should have Paul like dial in or come in and say, see, Jim, I told you it all work out. And he could say the same thing with me. And I mean, I remember, and we'll definitely have to send a separate invitation for Paul to join to Real Talk or to listen to this one. But he's also been a mentor of mine, as you know, and we both look to him as someone who combined both an entrepreneurial spirit, business, investment, while being a lawyer. Now he's been successful both at Colony and Miramar. And, he's a great client of ours as well. So look, Jim, I really appreciate you coming on. It's just great to reminisce about the Latham days, to hear how you transitioned from Latham to the real estate world, something that I would love to do myself. But I'm too busy doing this podcast now, so I don't know if I can, but I really appreciate you coming on, and congratulations, with all your success.
Thanks, Andrew. It's great to see you and catch up, man. Really appreciate it.
All right. Take care. Bye-bye.
See ya.
Bye. You've been listening to Real Talk, Real Estate Discussions with Andrew Kirsch. You can catch prior episodes at www.sklarkirsch.com and on YouTube, LinkedIn, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, and more. Thank you for your positive reviews, comments, and sharing this show with others.